I think it's May 5th, 1981, and my name is Dwayne Cox, and I'm doing an oral history interview with Becky Hudson, who is the former, up until just the other day, was women's athletic director at the University of Louisville, had been basketball, women's basketball coach at U of L, and professor in the HPER department, and other things too. And I always start out by asking somebody just to say a little bit about where they're from and their education and their parents and how they got interested in what they're interested in. So.
Well, I am a Kentucky native from a small town below Lexington named Millersburg, Kentucky. Basically a farm girl. Family moved to Lexington when I was 14, and as a consequence, residing in Lexington and at the University of Kentucky became possible for me to go to school. I love sports and athletics, and probably take that affection from my father, who at one time aspired to a coaching degree but was unable to finish. Family that is involved in sport, so it just seemed natural. Not wanting to be a secretary, not wanting to be a nurse, that teaching would become a vocation or an avocation. And I guess in a sense I kind of lucked into physical education, or straight into it, because it was never something I ever thought about. From there, with a degree from UK, I went to California, spent a couple of years teaching in junior high, and realized that I didn't want to do that the rest of my life, although I enjoyed it. Came back, got a master's degree from the University of Kentucky in about 1964. Taught in a small junior college in Virginia. Taught elementary physical education. Bounced around really looking for a place to settle and something that I enjoyed when the opportunity to work at the University of Louisville occurred. And in fact, the interesting thing about it was that the chairman of the department, who was John Heldman, actually wrote a letter to me indicating that he knew I was in the area and would I be interested in the intramural directorship for women at U of L. At the time, I was teaching elementary PE, and a college position is something I was very interested in, so I came up for an interview, and I think that was in June, and in August I had a new job at U of L in 1968.
In 68. Right. Can you say a little bit more about were you in athletics in high school?
No, in fact, it is the very fact that I had no opportunity to play in organized sport that probably ultimately has led me to an almost, I hate to say this, soft militant role in athletics. In the entire secondary and elementary education experience that I had in the state of Kentucky, I had 1 year of physical education in the ninth grade. I was fortunate that I had teachers who might have occasional field days, and we'd have track meets, so I was a good fast runner, so I could get a ribbon for being a 50-yard sprinter. Interestingly enough, I played on the ninth grade boys football, flag football team. I was an excellent athlete at the time, and I think that was the sad part about it. It's a great, you know, I had really strong potential as an athlete, and no outlet for my love. I played summer softball. I played in a disorganized metropolitan basketball league in high school
in Lexington.
You know, working with people who genuinely cared but who lacked any kind of real expertise or knowledge in coaching fundamentals or even working with children. And from that perhaps grew a need or a sense in me that I had lost an opportunity. because of the lack of qualified personnel. Maybe that's what led to the physical education degree. My loss of opportunity. When I came to Louisville, I came only because it was an opportunity to make more money and to get involved in the college scene. And, of course, the opportunity to coach basketball was exciting to me. I did play college basketball at UK.
Oh, you did?
And I played the college on the volleyball team and on the softball teams. But you've got to remember that was 1958, 1962. And again, with no secondary physical education, no organized girls' sports in Kentucky, with the exception of swimming. We played 5 or 6 basketball games a year. We had a squad of 22 girls on the basketball team. Everybody would get to play. And it used to irritate me to a great deal that we could be winning a ball game, but in order to get the necessary time in for everybody to play, the best people sat out while everybody else ran in. And I think that's my love of varsity competition is the best you compete. And well, we have, like I said, 22 people. We 5 or 6 games for the year. Our major excitement was to get on a bus to Miami University in Ohio and get to play a basketball game up there and get to eat out. Somebody paid our way and came back. And that was probably the biggest thing we did in my entire college varsity experience.
Did you, I don't want to sound like a hindsight or anything, but did you not like that?
I detested it.
Can you talk about that some?
Well, as I said, I have a brother who is a year older than I am. And my brother and I were both excellent athletes. My sister is a year younger than I am as an excellent athlete. My brother was able to play football at Lexington Lafayette for 4 years. And every Saturday night, my family trooped out and we watched my brother do all those fantastic things on the field and get the write-ups for having been a 40, 60-yard ground gainer or scoring a touchdown. When the track season rolled around, he set state records for the 100 and 200-yard dash. And, of course, I'm sitting there yelling and screaming and at the same time thinking that in the backyard, you know, I play basketball. I was pretty darn close to it. But none of those experiences existed for me. There wasn't even an organized event in my life until the Metropolitan Softball Leagues. And even at that, I was a 14 or 15-year-old girl playing with 40-year-old women. Big, burly, ugly women that frightened me. You know, they talked rough, they drank. You know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that except when you're 14, all you want to do is play, but you got to play under some less than, I think, good circumstances. And, yes, it irritated me. Extremely. Then to go to college and see, you know, the Fabulous Five, and well, they weren't the Fabulous Five when I was there, but there was a group that came close to winning the NCAA title, I'd say, somewhere in that time span of 60 to 65. And to go to Memorial Coliseum, where the men's basketball team played regularly on a daily basis, and yet we had to playing an old women's gym that's about as big as 60 by 80. You could shoot from one end of the court to the other, make a goal. I'm not saying at that time I gave a great deal of thought to it, but I think it disturbed me that I didn't have a chance to take home a prize or a ribbon or essentially get good coaching. It disturbed me that my skill was just floating around and coming from a middle class or a lower middle class family, I didn't have the resources to play tennis, golf, swimming, which were the 3 sports at that time that if you had money, a woman had an opportunity to excel. But if a team-oriented person, or someone interested in something other than swimming, tennis, and golf where it took money, was just really left out in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I went to California and taught for 2 years. And saw a whole new world. Because mm-hmm. I went out there and they had physical education every day, uh-huh. 5 days a week from the first grade through the 12th grade. They had a fourth or sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth grade boys football team, but they also had organized what I call GAA or Girls mm-hmm. Athletic Association activities for girls. Mm-hmm. And so every day after school, I might have 20 to 60 girls in the gym staying after school for organized sport competition. You know, I think part of it was at my insistence that it got done, but the thing is that the school supported it, that money was allowed and allocated for competition if someone chose to put in the time. I wasn't paid. In Kentucky, there wasn't even access to a facility. Even if the teacher wanted to do something for you, she couldn't get to the gym. Mm-hmm. She couldn't get to the track because yeah. the boys were always there.
Yeah.
And in those days, we didn't have the mass transportation potential we have now. Mm-hmm. You couldn't stay till 7 o'clock at night, and your parents didn't take you over to the high school at 7 and come back pick you up at 9 o'clock like they might do today.
Did you, when you were in, when you taught in high school and in junior college, did you coach and teach?
Yes, I did.
Tell the names of the
okay,
places.
Okay, I was at Victor Valley Junior High School. It was my first teaching job, flat out of UK. I taught physical education 5 days a week, no health, and uh-huh. that's important because that's unique. That you don't have to teach health in Kentucky, you have to teach health in PE in uh-huh. order to make physical education a legitimate uh-huh. academic uh-huh. subject. In Victor Valley, like that was a 7th, 8th, 9th grade. Uh-huh. I ran and organized the GAA for girls. Uh-huh. I coached a track team for girls. And in the afternoon, we played basketball intramurals, archery, mm-hmm. track, soccer, all the intramural programs I conducted. Actually, I didn't coach there, but I just taught extramural activities, mm-hmm. intramural activities, and I was a cheerleading sponsor, mm-hmm. so they went to all the boys' football and basketball mm-hmm. games. Mm-hmm. Then I came back, got my degree. I went to Virginia Intermont.
You came back and got a master's.
I came back and got a master's.
UK, right?
And ended up in a small junior college in Bristol, Virginia, called mm-hmm. Virginia Intermont Junior College, mm-hmm. where I coached tennis and field hockey and basketball and volleyball mm-hmm. in addition to my teaching duties. I only stayed a year. But it only had to do with the community, not necessarily the institution. Mm-hmm. It was a good experience. My basketball team went to 10-1 for the year. I think that's where my real love of basketball grew. We, mm-hmm. Our first game, we got beat 25 points. We never lost another game and then beat that same opponent at the end of the year mm-hmm. by 14 points. So I think I grew a little bit as a coach. The thing about a position like that is when you're coaching four sports and then you're teaching, you never have any time to yourself. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I decided I'd try to come back to Kentucky in order to find a job in a college here. I wrote, nothing was open, so I said, well, I'll come back to live and hope something will open up. Mm-hmm. I taught elementary PE for a year. So I had not done any coaching except that 1 year of collegiate experience. When the job at Louisville occurred,
68.
And I was hired to be an intramural director and to teach physical education activities courses. At the same time, there was an indication that the basketball team didn't have a coach. Would I be interested in that? And I said, well, I had no opposition to it. I'd give it a whirl. Mm-hmm. When I got here, the basketball program, or any of the varsity programs, I would say were simply very similar to anything I had experienced in my high school days. or UK playing days, mm-hmm. 5 or 6 games. Mm-hmm. One of the professors volunteered time to coach. The girls paid their own way, drove their own cars. Coaches simply wrote letters to other colleges to say, would you like to get together on mm-hmm. Saturday afternoon mm-hmm. or Thursday at night or mm-hmm. something. And that was my first experience in coaching mm-hmm. ranks in 68.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what, just generally, what was your first impression of UofL?
Oh, I loved it. I felt that, for one thing, it was much bigger than Virginia Intermont, which is a junior college. Mm-hmm. The physical education department had a much bigger staff, and men and women rather than all women, which mm-hmm. is what I had come from. Teaching the activities courses was probably no different. But I believe I felt that this was a big institution, and at the time it wasn't. It was mm-hmm. about 6,000 undergraduates.
Yeah.
But to me, coming from only small high school, junior high, and small college, mm-hmm. it seemed like a parallel step to the University of Kentucky mm-hmm. in terms of opportunity. Mm-hmm. I thought the physical education staff was made up of nice people, good-natured people. I'm not sure that I was terrifically impressed with the expertise mm-hmm. of the intellect that you mm-hmm. might find on other campuses. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like a good place to begin a mm-hmm. college career.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned John Hellman.
Yes, John was the department chairman, and apparently, and I think this is still the case at UofL, and I don't want to step on anybody's toes, but I think that chairman in this particular institution, PE, are figureheads.
Mm-hmm.
They're the good guys who will accept the responsibility and not necessarily the most competent for the position. John was one of those who'd outlived everybody else in the department. Mm-hmm. He was older than everybody else, and as a consequence, inherited mm-hmm. the chairmanship. Mm-hmm. And he was the kind of guy that probably in today's university would just be a lost marble
mm-hmm.
because he did everything by telephone, verbal agreement,
mm-hmm.
Never wrote anything
uh-huh.
down.
Uh-huh.
Was full of wonderful stories. Believed in getting along at all costs. Sometimes at the cost maybe of his program, just
uh-huh.
get along.
Uh-huh.
He had an ongoing feud, if that's matter, an ongoing feud with Sue Hall.
Oh, really? Does anybody know the origins of
that? Well, I tell you, Duane, the origins are rooted very deeply in physical education.
Oh, really?
And that is the separation of departments. Men's physical education and women's physical education. I think that the feminist movement has been in physical education for centuries, where men had all the opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Women had the jobs, but had fewer resources mm-hmm. to work with. Mm-hmm. I think that was the case here mm-hmm. in most institutions. When I went to UK, we had a women's PE department, we had a men's PE department,
mm-hmm.
then we had an athletic department.
Mm-hmm.
When I came to Louisville, we had a women's PE department. Well, we had women's PE in Belknap Building.
Mm-hmm.
We had men's PE in Crawford Gym.
Mm-hmm.
That ought to tell you something right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who had
yeah.
the nice building, who
sure.
had the resources.
Sure.
Then we had an athletic department, which at that time, I don't really know where the athletic department mm-hmm. was. I guess it was someplace mm-hmm. else. And I think that probably down through the years, because Dr. Hall and Dr. Hellman had been working together and living together and trying to coexist together for probably 10 years before I ever got here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that their distance was created by Dr. Hall wanting more,
mm-hmm.
as most women have wanted in physical education, and Dr. Hellman holding on to what he had, which is what men still are tending to do in athletics.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
I think that's probably where we are even today in the total area of athletics. The revenue sports have a great deal,
mm-hmm.
which they're very unwilling to relinquish mm-hmm. for those who mm-hmm. are non-revenue mm-hmm. oriented. And it hasn't changed. The combatants are different. The situations are certainly improved for both sides, but it's going to be a long time before it's resolved.
Who were some of the other people that you first met at U of L, and some of the old timers who were around then, and what were the buildings like back in those days?
Well, of course, I mentioned Crawford, and it was a spanking new building just about when I came, probably 5 years old, and the showcase for this campus. Belknap Gym was old and dilapidated, but still very functional. Gardner Hall was probably the place where I met Dean Barber
uh-huh.
at the time. Richard Barber was Dean of A&S at the time and interviewed me when I mm-hmm. I was here for my mm-hmm. interview. And I was impressed with Dick Barber with his sense of his wit, his intellect,
mm-hmm.
And the fact that he believed that physical education intramurals was an integral part of the academic setting,
mm-hmm.
that going to classes was just one part of education.
Mm-hmm.
I felt very, very tuned to him at the time. I'm trying to think of some of the other people maybe throughout the university. Ellis Mendelson was even then a legend on campus. And Ellis, of course, I was the women's intramural director, and Ellis was the men's intramural director. Said I was just a baby coming into this situation. I knew nothing and cared nothing except that I had a good opportunity. Ellis and I fortunately formed a very good association and a very good working situation, primarily, I think, because I didn't threaten his particular situation. But rather eliminate some of the workload that he presently had, because his program even then was highly organized. But he was doing the same things then he's doing now, trying to use as many facilities as he could possibly get, always asking for more money and more time and more help. He hasn't changed a bit. I think Dr. Strickler was the president at the time.
Yeah.
And although I did not meet Dr. Strickler other than an occasional reception line, I remember his wife, Florence, was a very influential person on this campus. I think a lot of us looked to her for the kinds of things that seemed to be missing in an institution that's so much larger now, and that was the personal touch. She maybe didn't know your name, but she knew how to make you feel comfortable and that you were maybe doing something important wherever you were, whether you were in the library or physical education or over in the student cafeteria. Dave Lawrence was dean of students, and who was the dean of women at the time? Doris Stokes.
Yeah.
And Pat Allison was an assistant dean.
Mm-hmm.
And Harold Adams was some kind of an assistant to both of them. And I think I probably spent a great deal of time with those four because my job as intramural director related a great deal to student affairs. So we had some good times with Dave and Doris, who had been here for centuries. But I think I remember them. I think Polly Wood was even then an assistant to the Dean of Arts and Science. And Clark Wood was a professor, an assistant professor in the department then. When Dr. Hellman died, or retired rather, Clark became the chairman. The people I met probably through the years were, you know, I knew Frank Camp, and didn't know him too well. The one I remember most is Peck Hickman, because I worked for him one summer in a kind of summer youth employment camp or something. And Peck was not anything like John Hillman, who would ask you to do something 3 or 4 times to try to work. Peg just said, do it, and it got done. Uh-huh. He was that kind of person. Mm-hmm. Lee Corso coached here while I was here, and I remember Lee because Lee spent a great deal of time trying to convince the faculty that we ought to take care of the ghetto boys out of the north in order to make his football team thrive. I guess Jim Bible was a trainer here and had been for about 30 years. He has since gone with Lee to Indiana. Yeah. One of the things I remember about Jim was that he was so frightened of women in the training room. So when I first came here, the training room belonged only to the men. Uh-huh. Women weren't permitted to go in. Uh-huh. And when we asked why, we were told that the men run around naked. Mm-hmm. Now, all the men do in the training room, we get rub downs, get in the hot water, things,
whirlpool,
things like that. We always wondered why they couldn't put on their trucks, because we could put on our bathing suits. Mm-hmm. Finally, we got that taken care of, but it does go, I think, in retrospect, it goes to show you how difficult it is for women to ask for change, even of a minute nature. Uh-huh. Those are so traditional in men's programs that they have a difficult time giving them up.
What was, talk some about the women's intramural program, which you were...
Okay, the women's intramural program was, at the time I came, and I really didn't change it much because intramurals is not a love of mine. Mm-hmm. Philosophically, I believe it's the right approach to competition, but I had had all those years of such poor organization that I think I kind of assumed that intramurals meant poorly organized activity for women, so I didn't have a great affection. I wanted the job, so I'd do it. It was primarily a development of recreational activities for the sororities on campus. Mm-hmm. And most of the activities that I conducted were designed for the sororities. Mm-hmm. We'd have hockey in the fall, we'd have volleyball at night, we'd have basketball, and all the sororities would get together, you know, the Pi Fives would get their team up against the, I'm trying to think of him, was it Sigma Kappa? No, that's men's, isn't it?
I don't know, I never was.
anyway, it was an important part of campus life for the sororities. When I came, my love of competition spilled over, I believe, into my students, my own physical education majors, and they became very, very active in the intramural program, which began to create a real problem because their skill level was so superior to the sororities that the sororities began to lose interest in the program. Uh-huh. We had that is still a problem at the university, permitting the athlete or the physical education major to come together in any kind of organized fashion, because when they do, they almost invariably dominate physical the sports program. Yeah. That's men and women alike. Yeah. However, I felt that they were just as entitled to organized sport as were the sorority girls, and we worked it out. The university wasn't big enough to separate sorority in one division and independence in another. That's what they do now. Mm-hmm. But at that time, we didn't. We just, every year, we switched the rules around or made some concession to one group or the other in order to keep the peace. Mm-hmm. It was a highly organized program. Mm-hmm. There was, I think, anywhere from 10 to 15 intramural activities for women. Mm-hmm. The programs they have now, they had then. Ellis and I did initiate co-rec activities, which is something that had not been done prior to my coming. We had co-rec basketball, co-rec volleyball, where men and women play together,
mm-hmm.
and co-rec softball. Mm-hmm. All of those occurred while I was still here and while he was the director of Intermountain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you were taking it on up to the present, is there more that you can say about the women's intramurals or intramurals in general?
I would say that the intramural department had been taken out of the mm-hmm. physical education department.
Mm-hmm.
So now we had an intramural department functioning in its own with its own mm-hmm. budget, and I had an athletic department I was going to functioning with its own budget. So we, neither Ellis nor myself, were suddenly restrained by budgets
mm-hmm.
that belonged to an academic department. And that, I think, enabled great growth in both areas,
mm-hmm.
in intramurals and mm-hmm. in athletics for women,
mm-hmm.
because it was the tie to the academic department and the budgeting restraints
mm-hmm.
that had limited growth to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Now intramurals is now in student affairs, athletics is in the athletic department. So when Ellis went to the student affairs office, more budget coming from the university in general rather than an academic department enabled him to pick up the necessary staff to give more time to women's intramurals, so that now he has a full-time assistant who runs the women's intramural
mm-hmm.
program.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't have to coach basketball on the
mm-hmm.
side, and she's not coaching, she's not teaching five classes
mm-hmm.
a day, which is what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. What were the most jobs you ever had at one time?
Well, at one time, I was the basketball coach, the intramural director, and I taught 12 hours per week.
Mm.
That
mm.
when I first came here, that was my job.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, Duane, I thought that was
not too hard.
I had a lot of energy, and I was only 27 years old.
Yeah.
That's not too bad when you're 27.
What about the, you talked a little bit about the physical education department when you came here, and I wondered if you could talk more about how it's changed or how it hasn't changed. And you said one thing that was interesting to me, and I'm not sure I understand exactly what you mean, but I think maybe what you meant was that the departmental chairman or woman. Not just in physical education, but maybe all of the departmental chair people aren't very powerful. Is that accurate? Is that what you meant?
I'm not sure that's accurate. That's a personal opinion.
Yeah.
I have felt that this is my viewpoint of the University of Louisville.
Uh-huh.
Just overall, that the majority of the people up until a few years ago, the administrative positions were filled by those people who had worked
uh-huh.
in this institution when it was a small private
uh-huh.
institution.
Uh-huh.
As the institution became part of the state, and even as faculties expanded or staff numbers expanded, the people who were moved into administrative positions and into leadership roles were those people who had been here
mm-hmm.
in a small private institution.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm saying is I think that politically they got their positions because of their past ties and their friendships
uh-huh.
rather than the academic excellence or the administrative competence
uh-huh.
that they brought to the job, which is more typical of today's appointments than it was
I'd say
as much as 5 years ago.
I see.
As a result, I think they probably weren't as powerful
mm-hmm.
because they were good old Joes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you went to speak to a dean, at that time we didn't have too many vice presidents until about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
The dean was a buddy that you'd been drinking
yeah.
coffee with
yeah.
for 5 years, and I just don't
yeah.
think you have the
yeah.
same kind of power that you do now when you bring somebody in from New York or Pennsylvania or perhaps even from the University of Kentucky
mm-hmm.
who comes in on the basis of credentials
mm-hmm.
Rather than past sessions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk some about how the physical education department has changed.
Well, essentially, the department has changed not from the personnel. There are still many people who are on the staff now who were on the staff when I came here.
Mm-hmm.
There have been several people to leave and several people to replace them, but essentially the staff is the same. Mm-hmm. What has really changed perhaps in physical education has been more one of the goals of the department rather than the people within the department. When I came, our physical education department was one that was very general in nature. The purpose of the department was to prepare the young teacher to teach physical education activities in the local high schools. With the kind of demise of teaching colleges, so to speak, in many ways, the fact that we seem to be getting an abundance of young teachers, high school teachers in our programs, there was a move toward the research or preparation for a master's program that the department began to take that on. And when they brought in, I can't even remember the first guy, but Bruce somebody came from Ohio State, pretty much turned the department around, and we became a department of exercise physiology and research. Brian Stanford came, geez, I don't know, maybe 1970, 72. And with Brian's coming and the exercise physiology lab that we began to develop, I believe the physical education degree here began to take on that aspect, not activity oriented, but academically oriented and preparation for the master's program, and kind of an intent to give a liberal education, liberal background, less intent for skill. I personally have never felt that was a very good move. I think that we have a great number today of physical educators who had a great number of theoretical courses and know nothing about stringing an archery bow or hitting a badminton bird, and as a result, Kentucky high schools continue to turn out poorly skilled athletes compared to some of our other states. I think a good activities teacher, an individual who is very knowledgeable in how to teach somebody how to use a racket, throw a ball, kick a ball, run, is probably one of the most valuable people we have in today's society. We don't turn them out. And yet that's what people want. That's why people go to the tennis shops and play tennis pros, and go to the golf shops and play golf pros, come to Denny's camps in the summer. Pay $150 to have the little boy taught skills that physical educators could easily do in the high schools if they were maybe differently prepared than I think they are today.
Well, that's interesting.
Very biased opinion, but
whether your opinion is biased or not, you described an interesting trend, an interesting change.
Yes, I think physical education is no longer skills oriented. And when I was a major at UK, it was skills oriented. But I felt I was extremely well prepared to teach skills to young people. And I don't think that's true today. I think students today have a great deal of theory. They understand the sociology of sport. They understand the history of sport. They have an understanding of the principles of movement. They have an appropriate background in anatomy and physiology. But whether or not they really have a love and really have an understanding of the mechanics of movement as it relates to an implement or as it relates to a game, I question that.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, there was another, not long after you came to U of L, you talked about President Strickler, and you've alluded to it already. There was another, I guess, landmark in the history of the university, and that was state affiliation. Are there any things you can say just generally or specifically?
Very generally. Everything I'm saying is generally, because without my, you know, without notes and I'm not sure years are correct. These are really just off the top of my head remembrances.
Well, what about changes that you noticed since state affiliation?
The state to me was the best thing that happened to the University of Louisville. Mainly, I believe, because as I see the city of Louisville, not necessarily the institution or the university, I have always felt that Louisville was the center, the metropolitan center of the state of Kentucky, and that when I came to Louisville, I thought that if there was any place in the world you'd want to live, it would be. Any city you wanted to live in Kentucky would have to be Louisville, because none of the other cities measured up. They were basically, Lexington and all the other small towns were just overgrown farm towns anyway. Yet when I came here, it was the rare individual that had ever even heard of the University of Louisville or cared about it. And the only students that we had were those who had financial resources to come, because the tuition was quite exorbitant at the time. It was, I'm guessing, but I think we might have been paying like $50 an hour as an undergraduate here at U of L, when the state schools were paying 8 to 10.
Yeah.
So here you were with a potential great institution paying a lot of money for limited resources. I remember that when you wanted to do a paper at U of L in 1970,
we'll pick up that line.
If you wanted to make it accurate, you had to go to UK's library. So we had kids going and getting diplomas here who had to go to UK or IU to do the necessary research for their papers.
That's interesting.
And that's a terrible dilemma for a student who's paying five times the tuition, and at a time when you didn't have as many cars on the road, the interstates were just becoming completed. That was a terrible dilemma. Plus, the community itself, it was a municipal institution, which the city was always trying to get out of supporting. I mean, it was always a tax, it was always a burden to the city. Every time you read the newspaper, the city was trying to cut back and cut back and cut back. So here you had an institution that essentially was able to educate the kids of Jefferson County, and they were all leaving the county to go to school someplace else. And I just felt that it was coming from the Lexington, from the University of Kentucky, all you ever dreamed of in Lexington was going to UK. But one of the reasons you went was because you could afford it.
Yeah.
And here you were in Jefferson County, and you couldn't afford to come down here and go to school for 1 year for what you could almost get a full education at UK. So to me, the Jefferson County community is the real benefactor. And I thought it was an outstanding improvement as far as our own programs. It's like anything else, whenever you grow, you lose a great deal. You lose the personal touch. We lost the knowledge that we knew everybody on campus. The student-teacher ratio became magnified, and so you couldn't afford to let the students come into your office as often, because there were too many of them and you couldn't get things done. Then began the emphasis on research and publishing, and then the publish or perish. And then the fight over the almighty dollar, which we didn't have then. None of us had it then, and so none of us really worried about it. We just got by. Now, some have and some don't, so there's a consistent squall among those who have and those don't about what's the curse. So those are probably that, plus I think that used it in terms of personal reflection at a time when we've been building a great number of buildings as a result of our state association. There hasn't been as much attention paid to the salaries and to the staff support, the faculties, or administrators, which creates a problem to have a beautiful building that can't be maintained, to have a beautiful office desk, but you don't have paper supplies to put in it. I think those have created some concerns for some of us who were here 10, 15 years ago.
What about students? Have students changed since 1968, since at U of
M? Not now, but they went through a time when they were different. When I first came in 68, in fact, probably from 68 to about 74, maybe 75, I always felt the students were pretty much the same, even though we had the riotous 60s. UK was down there storming. The only real incident I remember here was the blacks, and they occupied the president's office. But I just don't believe the students on this campus have ever really been militant. I don't believe they've ever really been involved. I think it's a commuter institution, and the most exciting thing that happens in these kids' lives is what happens in their old high schools. When they go back home for the big game, what happens among their high school friends. Now that's changing a little, I believe, in the students I see. I'm not going to make a general observation because I'm seeing athletes now rather than the general student body, and the athletes are not all from Jefferson County. So they're not all as likely to go home and live in the city and ignore U of L as they used to be. I still feel the student body is apathetic. I believe that the general student here is interested in 4 years and a job. They're not here for a quest of knowledge. They're not here because they're hungry to learn or they're eager to learn. At the same time, I think we probably have some exceptional students like any campus. Overall, most of the kids are still worried about who they're dating on Saturday night and who's the easiest professor. I don't think kids ever change.
That's probably...
Other than the problems of today are different than those of 10 years ago. When I came in 68 and 70, the kids had ready jobs. They were prepared 3 or 4 years. They wouldn't have good jobs. Today, their degrees are almost bounced around. They're worried to death that they'll get any job, much less a job that they've been trained for. And that's not just true in teaching, that's true everywhere. And I think that does create an apathetic student. Why should you bust your butt when there's not going to be anything there anyway? Of course, I guess that's a generation change too. When my generation and that one that immediately preceded me the last 10 years, we always thought that even if you got the diploma, you had to go out and track down the job. Today's kid kind of thinks that the diploma means everybody's going to come after them.
I guess even after you became women's athletic director, I always thought of you as the women's basketball coach.
The basketball team?
Yeah, talk about your team.
Well, as I said, my first experience here, I was the youngest woman in the department. There were Dr. Sue Hall, Dr. Lois Massey, and Cheryl Breitmeyer. Were the three here, and I think any one of them is at least 15 years older than I am. So if you are a young woman athlete, to find youth in your program is exciting. It may be the same for men. I don't know, but a young coach who had a great deal of energy, that was me. And the kids, just anything I mentioned to them, they just gobbled it up. So we started out with It was typical for my basketball team to practice 2 days a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, because women didn't sweat. Remember, all this in perspective was just the way it was in those days. And my kids and I, we decided, well, that wasn't good enough. You know, we just couldn't learn in 2 days what was necessary to be good basketball players. So we moved to 5 days a week, which was unheard of. To some of my peers, my teaching peers, you know, they just, that was just it's an awful lot of work for those kids. So that was a real change. We went to 5 days a week. Then we went from 5 days for an hour a week to 5 days, 2 hours a week. Well, that was, I mean, you just, well, I was killing the kids. Of course, they were eating it up, so was I. We went from kind of an unorganized schedule to the fact that I sat down and I said, you know, we have all these schools around us and we ought to play everyone at least one time and occasionally play them more than once if we can afford it. And so I began to make overtures to the other coaches in the state. And I would say that I was very extremely involved, and one of the first women to get involved in what is called now the Kentucky Women's Intercollegiate Conference, which is the KWIC. I've served as president, commissioner of that conference, and all of this grew out of my coaching career. As far as coaching in those days, first of all, I volunteered my time. We didn't have uniforms. The kids wore probably blouses and gym shorts that they might have worn at U of L, or just everybody got together and one of the girls would go out and buy one pair of shorts and one buy a blouse. They all liked it, so they all bought it. We didn't have any money. Our first couple of years, we drove our own cars and we bought our own uniforms. This PE department provided us with a facility to play in and the balls.
And where was that? Where did you play?
We played right here in Belknap Gym.
Okay. Did you practice here?
We practiced here. We played and we practiced completely in this facility. We had, just getting out of it, we had scoring now. Scoring time, you don't think anything about it unless you're a coach. But my scoring timer, were this kid that I picked up that followed the team, and I said, I need a scoring timer for our five home games. Will you do it for me? And I trained them how to do it. And they sat at a little table in the middle of the gym. And we had 10 chairs on one side of the table and 10 chairs on the other side of the table. And that's what the typical game looked like downstairs, 20 chairs and two teams running up and down the court. And a scoring timer, we had a hand, it was a clock that you turned by hand, just an old-fashioned clock. But it had 8 minutes, 10 minutes, and it went bzzzt when the time was up. And we had a 30-second watch, stopwatch, that we used to time 2 minute quarters, things like that. Because when I was a coach, we played the six-player game. We had four quarters. So when I, like I said, now women's basketball then was six players. You had three on one side, one end of the court, three offensive players, and you had three defensive players. Additionally, two of those players, I don't know if you know anything about basketball, two of those players were rovers, which meant that one of the offensive players could play defense, and one of the defensive players could play offense. So you could end up with what's called an unbalanced court, four and two. And I was really an excellent coach at that particular game. I had a defense that we kind of invented, played around with, and as a result, since everybody played zones in those days, nobody played player to player, what you call man to man. We were exceptional.
So women's coaches say player to player.
Yeah, we say player to player. No, we still say man to man. But I think if you look at it, you'll see young women say man to man. Women my age will say player to player. And a great deal of it is from which, you know, which place you're coming from. And
they never say woman to woman?
Never say woman to woman. Okay. Most young coaches have not experienced the past prejudices, perhaps, that we have, and so maybe they have other problems than we do. Anyway, we were exceptionally fortunate at the time because I had a group of freshmen and sophomores that probably come along once or twice in the lifetime of a coach or a player, and that their personalities and their skills all mesh together. In particular, the one athlete that is outstanding in my mind is Maureen Arini Wilkins.
Mm-hmm.
Rini is presently our assistant basketball coach at the university. Mm-hmm. Rini is probably one of the best shooting guards that ever lived in the state of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And that's including today's fine athletes.
Mm-hmm.
She was just an exceptional shooting guard.
Mm-hmm.
She averaged 22 points a game, and there's just very few ways to guard her.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that was in a game with the Rover, the
mm-hmm.
five-player game today. She might have scored even more.
Mm-hmm.
Her high school games, she played at Assumption High School.
Mm-hmm.
And the Catholic leagues at the time had good basketball programs and good sports programs for girls,
mm-hmm.
the private girls' schools.
Mm-hmm.
They always have.
Mm-hmm.
The public schools, when I came to Jefferson County, were just beginning to get involved in girls' basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So Rini was somewhat a product of that,
mm-hmm.
that era, or that beginning. And Dottie Galligan, who's from Jeffersonville, Indiana, came to school here. And Dottie and Rini were just two exceptionally fine players. And I happened to have these two exceptionally fine players at the time when I was coaching.
Mm-hmm.
So we, I remember the first time we played the University of Kentucky, which Louisville had been playing Kentucky for a long time in women's basketball,
mm-hmm.
this very moderate level. And it meant more to me than anything in the world to beat my alma mater.
Yes.
And we did.
Yeah.
And it was the first time Louisville had beaten UK
uh-huh.
in probably its entire existence. So that set the tone for the future when you do things like that. We, I'm not quite sure of the year, but probably 71, we switched to the five-player game, which is the game the men play now.
Mm-hmm.
So my coaching went from the six-player to the five-player transition, and I have to admit that was the worst year of my coaching life.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to teach athletes to play two ends of the court when they'd only known how to play one,
mm-hmm.
offensive or defensive.
Mm-hmm.
You were trying to adjust from eight players on one end, which is the roving game, to 10 players on one end.
Mm-hmm.
Girls had never been trained in any of the skills, including myself, of like man-to-man guarding techniques.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you take for granted the term, don't give the baseline.
Mm-hmm.
You probably grew up, if you ever played basketball,
yeah.
with somebody teaching you
yeah.
that. Well, as early as 1972, we had never heard of that as women.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deny the baseline?
Mm-hmm.
Or the fundamental of overplay,
mm-hmm.
you know, keep that player, just overplay that player.
Mm-hmm.
They always go right, you overplay the right, you force them to the left.
Mm-hmm.
You take those terms for
mm-hmm.
granted. We just learn the
yeah.
entire vocabulary in a year's time. Guarding techniques, women and girls had never been taught how to properly guard or any kind of footwork. All we knew how to do was shoot, and rebound. That's all we'd been taught. So anyway, I remember we tried to learn the Auburn Shuffle.
Yeah.
And the Auburn Shuffle essentially is nothing but a give and go.
Yeah.
But I couldn't even, the give and go concept is alien to women in basketball because they had never been taught those techniques, because give and go is a technique of man to man. It's not a technique of the zone.
Yeah.
It's really not.
Yeah.
You learn it man to man, then you adapt it to a zone. Having played zone all those years, we just did not know those kinds of techniques. Overload, we knew the overload principle. Fast break. you take for granted how to run a fast break. We had never been able to play a fast break because a six-player game, you didn't play a fast break. There were always two defensive players down there when you got there. And even though you might go 3-on-2, you must remember that a fast break is, the defense is with the offense or even behind the offense. But in a six-player game, you never had the true 3-on-2.
Yeah.
You always had two and hopefully three.
Yeah.
So we had to learn how to the outlet pass.
Uh-huh.
You take for granted the outlet pass. We didn't know what an outlet pass was, because the women's game was a very controlled zone game in which you brought the ball.
Get to the tape. You just said, the last thing you said, I think, was that in men's basketball, that you took the outlet pass for granted. You were giving examples of things.
Yes, the outlet pass. Because the outlet pass is the beginning of the fast break.
Uh-huh.
Well, not ever having played a game that would permit the fast break, we never had to learn the outlet pass.
Uh-huh.
You simply got the rebound and then began a deliberate move down the court to outmaneuver your opponents.
Uh-huh.
Our women's game consisted basically of screening and shooting. In fact, if I remember, I'm not quite sure, Dwayne, but the six-player game, when the first year I taught it at U of L, or coached at U of L, you even had a three-dribble limit.
Huh.
So, now when I played myself as a player, we had three-dribble limit, and we had 3-3. You were offensive or defensive. You never even roved when I was a player. And so I was always an offensive player because I thought the only fun about the game was scoring. I would go down there and guard anybody for 30 minutes for anything. That's what I'm saying. Women just never played a full court of those two things in Kentucky. Now, they may have elsewhere, but not here. And so we really had to learn a whole new vocabulary since 1971 or 72. And if you ever have an opportunity to go look at a high school girls game now, you will have to marvel at how quickly women or coaches of the women's girls and women's games have utilized all the knowledge that the male coaches had at their disposal for the past 20 or 30 years. And we learned most of what we learned from them. When I was coaching, I recall that the most important thing I did was go to clinics. I remember once going to a big clinic in Michigan for Johnny Orr. And being surprised that I knew terms that he was using that many of the women that I was sitting with, they themselves still were not familiar with the terms he was using because it was so hard to keep up and teach and everything else. It is the reason I got out of coaching, is that to have been fair to the athletes here, I needed so much more training and knowledge that I felt like it would be better to bring somebody young in who already had some of that rather than to try and go back and get it myself. I mean, if I'd been a younger person, I might have, but I wasn't.
We had what kind of coach were you? Were you a mean coach? We had a mean coach when I was in.
No, I would say I probably don't really know how to be mean. And I would say that I was probably not terribly demanding in the sense that perhaps a Bobby Knight might be or Joe Hall. But I will say that I was the kind of coach that I had expectations. And I expected you to want to do. If, for example, I recall one occasion that I sent my team out, my starters out, and they were just terrible. It was just like they were going through one of their practices, just lack of days. I pulled them all, made them run what we call suicides, which are those back from the free throw line to midcourt. I call them suicides, there are all kinds of names for them. And I pulled them out of the game on the side of Belknap Gym, and while I put my subs in, my regulars were running suicides on the side, which you never see in a men's game, obviously. Yeah. But I was just so angry that my expectations and their attempts to excel were just so far apart. I was demanding of them. I always told them, why do we practice 10 hours a week and go out and look like we never saw basketball? But I was not mean. In fact, if I look back now, I would think that I should have been much more demanding than I was. My reason for not being terribly demanding is that I was working with a non-scholarship athlete who chose to play, who, at a time when I was coaching, was paying five times that tuition down at UK. And some of them had part-time jobs in order just to go to school. Well, I just didn't feel like they could come into the gym five times a week and have me yell and scream at them all week long when they were there on a volunteer basis. It had to be enjoyable, or it would have been a waste of both of our times. So, by today's standards, you know, with kids on full scholarship and knowing that they don't have part-time jobs and everything, I might be a much more exacting coach than I was then.
Describe a typical practice session.
Oh, okay. Well, it lasts about 2 hours. We'd spend the first 5-10 minutes in flexibility exercises, trying to stretch the muscles so that there wouldn't be any injuries. Then we'd probably go through 15 to 30 minutes of shooting drills, weaves, layups, ball handling drills, maybe just passing the circle, trying to teach them aggression, things of that nature, keep away, things like that. Then we'd spend the next 30 minutes probably in going through specific drills that were offensive in nature. In other words, these were part of our game plan. And if, for example, we were going to work part of in the five-player game, I had an established pattern. And the wing passed to the corner and cut through. And then the forward in the corner shifted out. So we always had an over... what's the word I want to use? We always had a overbalance court. I said three players on one side, two on the other, hope that we could break most of the zones that we played against and overload. So we practiced that pattern quite a while, trying to execute the shots off of that. We could take. Then for about 10 minutes, we might work on special situation. For example, jump ball or under the goal or something like that. Then we'd scrimmage 15-20 minutes of the practice. And when I was having an unusually bad time with them, because the problem then was that I was working with myself a limited knowledge of what even a practice was like. See, I remember my experience as a player were with coaches of limited knowledge. And so I'd never been through a practice probably in any like you have in my life. So I was structuring the practice on what I thought was appropriate based on clinic observations and things of that nature. And that time, I could have gone over and watched Denny when I was teaching classes when he was practicing. So how could you go watch Denny from 1 to 3 when you had your own classes? Okay, I was working on limited knowledge, and my players had no experience of practice because of the limited knowledge they were getting in the high schools. So we were kind of flirting around for what was right. And their whole concept of practice was to go out and scrimmage. And of course, mine was, no, you can't scrimmage until you know what it is you're trying to do. So we came into a lot of conflict because they get so tired of doing the same drills over and over and over and over. And I'd have to say, but girls, if you can't dribble, pass, and shoot, under these circumstances, it has to be habitized. You can't do it in a game. Mm-hmm. Well, today's player, if you go over there, you'll see a rare scrimmage. Very rare that players scrimmage today. Mm-hmm. They will go through their pattern offenses. They'll set up individual skills, isolated skills. And then they'll run 2-on-3 or 3-on-3 in their pattern mm-hmm. offenses. Mm-hmm. But you just don't see them, all 10 of them out there running mm-hmm. up and down the court playing. Mm-hmm. But from Mike, and they accept it because they're used to it. They're mm-hmm. used to that kind of practice setting. It prepares them for the game. They know, for example, where always to tap the ball because they practiced it so many times. Mm-hmm. It becomes reflex. And my kids practice it, but at the same time, remember, they didn't have the playing experience. They had played 20 games in high school. Mm-hmm. So just to get out there and play was what they...
Yeah.
It was a little bit like street ball. They just wanted to go out there and mix it up. We had a lot of fights over that.
What do you think was your greatest accomplishment or your most exciting moment as a coach?
Well, I think there are two different things. My greatest accomplishment was that in 72 or 71, I'm not sure the date, my team was invited to the National Invitational Tournament mm-hmm. in Cullowhee, North Carolina mm-hmm. at Appalachian State. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it was Cullowhee, but it was close to that. Now, this was the forerunner of the National Collegiate Championships today. Mm-hmm. And because of our 10-1 or 10-2 record in the area, we got an invitation. Mm-hmm. That meant we got to get on a bus and drive all the way to North Carolina, or van rather, uh-huh. stay for 3 or 4 days in the national tournament. Mm-hmm. To me, that was my greatest accomplishment, mm-hmm. that at a time when women's basketball was just beginning to make a structure that would afford championship opportunities, we got an invitation. Mm-hmm. That was my greatest accomplishment. My greatest thrill was that the year before that, we were playing the University of Kentucky in Lexington at Transylvania College. And at halftime, we were down 33 points. My sister, my mother were sitting in the stands. Of course, this is 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and nobody else is around except family and friends. But we had always had pretty good games with UK, and while we may have won or lost, we had never been so soundly defeated. And yet in the next half, my team came back and won the ball game. And it was one of those situations where my center would rebound on one end and be down shooting on the next end. Uh-huh. That everybody seemed as if they just pulled every available muscle together mm-hmm. and said, we are going to do it, because I had just given them a scathing lecture in the locker room.
What'd you tell them?
Well, I told them it was probably the most embarrassing moment I'd ever spent as a coach, that mm-hmm. I realized that we might necessarily not win the game, but that it was outrageous to go out there and look like we'd never even seen a basketball. And I just couldn't believe that we'd spent all these hours practicing all these games leading up to this, and then to go out there in front of the most prestigious school in the state and to absolutely be humiliated, which at that point we were being humiliated. And the reason we were being humiliated, if I recall, was that everybody was so damn busy being the star that we had lost the concept of the team game. But if you don't pull together, yeah. you can't win in basketball. It's a complete team game. Anytime you become individually motivated and exclude your teammates, you're going to lose in the game of basketball. And you can't really care who scores. You can't really care who gets the most rebounds. You can't really care who has a bad game. You can't care about any of that. Because if you start isolating all those things, you lose the concept and lose the game. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I probably told them if they didn't do a little bit better, I wouldn't feed them. I'm not quite sure. But I did say to them, I said, my sister's out there in the audience, and she has never seen us play before. And I said, I am embarrassed to death. Now, you just get back out there, and if you don't play better, and I probably said to them, if you don't look better, I said, you will run until you can't talk for the next 6 days. I'm sure God knows what else I said, because I could get very scathing at times. It's probably one of the few times when I cursed a great deal, which in those days and times, I think women didn't even cuss. So anyway, they must have listened, because they came back and they did a magnificent job, and it was terribly thrilling.
Yeah.
We won the ball game, and the other coach was just standing around absolutely, you know, dumbfounded and shocked, because 33 points in a women's game is unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
At that time.
What about your saddest moment, or the thing that you something that you feel like you failed at
women's
basketball?
Remember, I told you my greatest accomplishment was going to the National Invitational, and I feel that was my greatest failure. That it was at that time that I realized that I lacked the knowledge and the know-how and the expertise to compete against the best.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could compete back home, but we weren't the best. We were only, in this area, basketball was only average. It wasn't good. And when I went to the National Invitational, I realized, for example, that my team could destroy any zone. We could bring anybody out of the zone. When they went player to player, man to man on us, suddenly my limited knowledge of that game was costing my team the opportunity to win. Because we'd be tough for one half, and then the second half we'd be blown away against the really good teams. Because the coaching expertise there was so much greater than I had.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that I had failed my athletes. I'm not saying that I knew it at the time.
Yeah.
I just felt like that I had brought them to a point through hard work and love and concern, but not necessarily confidence. And then I failed them in not having the confidence to prepare them for, because they had they got beat by the eventual champion, Westchester, and got beat by like 35 points. Well, that's very humiliating in a national tournament to get beat by 35 points. Now I realize that can happen to anybody, but then it really hurt me, because I don't think I'm a real perfectionist, but I like to think that I've done all that I can to do the best possible job within my ability. And yet, if you look at the NCAA finals this year, you will have seen instances in which very good men's teams literally got beaten to pieces by a team like Indiana. See, I can look back and realize I didn't have that terrible failure. It wasn't necessarily just my coaching that limited us in playing, but the skill level of my athletes probably was not comparable to the skill level. We weren't big and we weren't strong, and I had a bunch of Kentucky kids who didn't even have good, strong movement fundamentals, much less sports skills fundamentals. And I was playing kids in Pennsylvania who had 5 to 6 years of high school physical education. So I felt that was a real disappointment. My real sadness in terms of being a basketball coach was losing Reedy. The one player who, to me, epitomized the very best of the athlete. She was such a determined athlete who was willing to take on anything in order to accomplish. She was, she's the kind of kid, if you get her now, she'd be an All-American on your college team, because there's no amount of work you could give her. There was no amount of expectations you could ask of her that she wasn't already demanding of herself. And she was one of those students, or one of those people who expected it from herself but brought out the best in her peers. A lot of kids today and some even that I coached, there were a lot of great athletes, mm-hmm. skill-wise, but their leadership was negative mm-hmm. rather than positive. In other words, sometimes, you know, if you've ever coached, between an athlete and a coach, there are only, to me, two conditions. I'm with you or I'm against you. You know, it's my skill and my talent so that together we do this, mm-hmm. or my skill and my talent because we are in competition. Mm-hmm. And it's a perfectly natural situation. Mm-hmm. Most really good athletes that I worked with were in competition to prove their superiority with their peers, mm-hmm. or to show me that they knew as much as I did. I mean, I think that's mm-hmm. the competitive nature of the athlete a lot mm-hmm. of times. Mm-hmm. But then you get a kid like Rini who says, I am this good, and you have this, and I have this together, let's make it. So mm-hmm. really, when I lost her real...
Now, what do you mean when you lost her? Did she just graduate?
She just graduated and yeah. played yeah. the last game. Yeah. The last game was a very sad one
yeah.
because it was the end of that 4 years in which we had done so well mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. athletically. And the next 2 years were a little bit, I think I coached 6 years here. The next 2 years, we did, in fact, lose more ball games, and, you know, I just never had quite the teams that I'd had with her. I'm sure Danny's got the same concerns, you know. There
yeah.
some teams, this championship team, will never be another one like it.
Yeah.
And somewhere, that's probably somewhere in his mind, there's that athlete that made the difference. It could be Daryl, but it could be somebody else.
Yeah.
But somebody made that team unique to him.
Yeah.
And Rini made that team unique to me.
Yeah. Yeah. What about changes? You talked about how I thought that was fascinating about how the difference in the style, the rules changed mm-hmm. and how you had to adapt to that. What about you talked some about the uniforms and how people drove their own cars and things when you first started. Did that change or was
oh,
that?
Oh yes. In fact, today the best I can describe it is I'll make a comparison and say 70 or 72, maybe 72 because that's before I became the mm-hmm. athletic director mm-hmm. as a coach. We went to the National Invitational in North Carolina in uniforms that had been purchased for us by Dr. Sue Hall. She gave mm-hmm. them to us. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she wouldn't even let me tell the players because she was afraid she would be embarrassed by having given them the gift. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. But maybe it's because in her heart, she never approved of varsity athletics.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept of varsity versus everybody gets to play.
Mm-hmm.
We went in a van. We stayed in a dorm. The school there put us up in dorms. We ate at the school cafeterias except one time when once or twice we ate on the road in a restaurant. And I can remember many a time in a restaurant where there'd be so many of us that we'd go in and help the cooks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I'd get a couple of my girls to act as waitresses mm-hmm. while the cook's trying to mm-hmm. prepare for us. We usually ate at McDonald's or someplace of comparable sub Jerry's. I mean,
yeah.
we're never at big. I didn't have a manager except somebody I could scrounge up that would do it for me as a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
None of my kids were on scholarship. None of them. Many of them had part-time jobs and had to work around... the part-time jobs didn't go on this trip. Almost all of us had to nearly beg our professors to let us out of classes so we could go down and play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that missing 3 days wouldn't mm-hmm. be the end of a lifetime in the class. Mm-hmm. Our send-off, Miss Strickler came down and said goodbye to us in the van. PE, people in the PE department came down and said goodbye to us and wished us good luck. We had maybe an article in the women's section of the newspaper indicating that
mm-hmm.
we had arrived at this point and we were going, not mm-hmm. the sports section, mm-hmm. in the women's section.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you compare that today,
yeah.
last year, or this past year, I went with the basketball team to our Metro Conference tournament.
Mm-hmm.
We had the girls bused to the airport, the university vans.
Mm-hmm.
They get in an airplane, and they fly to New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
to Tulane, to play in a tournament of comparable nature.
Mm-hmm.
They have flight bags that are made of all this beautiful synthetic leather,
mm-hmm.
probably cost $80 to $100 if you
mm-hmm.
bought them out.
Mm-hmm.
They are housed in the Marriott Inn
mm-hmm.
of Tulane. Of course, we get special prices, but
mm-hmm.
nevertheless, they're
mm-hmm.
right next to the French Quarter.
Mm-hmm.
So we stay there 3 to 4 days, and while we don't eat probably at Jerry's and things of that nature, we are a decent restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
They walk out on the floor with warm-ups, set of warm-ups, a red uniform and a white uniform, shoes purchased by the department.
Mm-hmm.
There were 3 coaches on the bench, a full-time coach who's paid a good salary, a full-time assistant coach who's paid a good salary,
mm-hmm.
and a part-time assistant coach who's probably close to a graduate assistant, 2 managers on tuition,
mm-hmm.
12 kids on scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Full scholarships, room, board, tuition. They go up to the table to get a watch because
mm-hmm.
they won the tournament. It
mm-hmm.
cost $150.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference in basketball between now and just
yeah.
probably a short
yeah.
10 years ago.
Yeah. How do you account for that?
Well, a lot of people, I would say, the revolution of the 60s, in a
mm-hmm.
sense, the social
mm-hmm.
the social changes, the feminist movement, the black movement,
mm-hmm.
All the things that have kind of contributed to an awakening of opportunity for women. It's the basic, cause.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd say I have to be part
mm-hmm.
of the basic cause
mm-hmm.
because I will assure you that you never get anything without asking.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody isn't there demanding, it
mm-hmm.
doesn't occur.
Mm-hmm.
No one offered us.
Mm-hmm.
No one says, well, Becky, what can we do for you?
Mm-hmm.
Just tell us what you want, we'll supply it. It's
mm-hmm.
been a long process of saying, we are at this level. We need this much more resources to get at this level. And then more and more and more. And every year, myself, I'm basically myself because I'm probably the only administrator in athletics
mm-hmm.
at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Any real concern for women. We've had, all the males
mm-hmm.
primarily
mm-hmm.
into football and basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have to say that the feminist cause, the black cause, the social enlightenment of the 60s has certainly helped. My own pushing, and of course that phenomena that in the high schools itself
mm-hmm.
has created the push
mm-hmm.
at the college
mm-hmm.
level, because at
mm-hmm.
the time that there was an awakening here, there was an awakening in the public
mm-hmm.
schools
mm-hmm.
that little girls should have the same opportunities as little boys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when those little girls get to be 18 and they get out here, they're not interested in saying, We had jackets in high school. We don't get jackets here.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to help freshmen.
Mm-hmm. How'd you go about that?
Well, I think one thing, and I forgot probably the most important thing that ever happened that created that, and that was the Title IX
mm-hmm.
Educational Amendments
mm-hmm.
Act that
mm-hmm.
in 1972. Demanded equal opportunity
mm-hmm.
for women in
mm-hmm.
athletics.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we're still not there,
mm-hmm.
but it had its impact.
Yeah.
Essentially, that's where I said nothing came about as a result of somebody saying, "What do you want?"
Mm-hmm.
giving it, but
mm-hmm.
a whole series of things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, for example, scholarships came as the result of a potential suit from one of our student athletes. Her name was Barbara Bates.
Mm-hmm.
And about 1974, we had a gymnastics coach here named Sharon Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I was a coordinator in the PE department for athletics. That meant that they took my intramural responsibility away and said, okay, Becky, handle athletics, because it's growing everywhere, all the other schools. Some of the older coaches like Lois Hall, or Lois Massey, and Sue Hall, and Cheryl Breitmeyer are reaching a point where they can no longer meet the demands of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Their talents and their skill levels are greater than mm-hmm. ours, and the time demands that they want from us we're unable to give. So I became a coordinator and relinquished my intramural activities. So I was still in the PE department. I had five or six sports that I was coordinating, which simply meant that I helped them get their transportation requests, and I helped them contact other schools and these kinds of things. At that time, one or two of the meets, not third in the state, not third in the mm-hmm. South, third in the nation. Mm-hmm. I mean, a gymnast in the U of L's campus finished third in the nation. At that time, we probably had, Corso wasn't here. I think somebody else was here as a football coach. And Denny hadn't won a national title, although Dromo, I think, was doing a very adequate job in basketball. And, you know, we had 60 or 70 men athletes on, male football players on scholarship, 15 male basketball players on scholarship, and perhaps a few swimmers here, there, and yon, and not one woman on scholarship. Mm-hmm. And Sharon Cooper, who was our gymnastics coach's husband, was a lawyer,
uh-huh.
a young attorney.
Uh-huh.
At a time, like I said, the 60s
yeah.
were beginning to bear fruit.
Yeah.
And they came to me and they said, what should we do? We want a scholarship. I said, we don't give scholarships. What should we do? And I said, the only thing I can counsel you is to write a letter to me requesting one. And then if I don't request one, I suggest, you know, in a sense, I mean, I didn't actually say do this, mm-hmm. but I said that if that doesn't work, I guess I suggest you might consider legal action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have no... That was my counsel. That was not my directive.
Mm-hmm.
As an administrator, I was not
mm-hmm.
in any way, shape, form going to say sue the university. But I did say you could try that. She did.
Mm-hmm.
She applied for a scholarship, and she was told by me, who was the coordinator at the time, scholarships were not available for female athletes.
Mm-hmm.
So she wrote a letter to one of the legal officers, I guess, in the institution at the time, making the same demand, and that if such was not forthcoming, you know, that they might file action for the scholarship.
Now, was this before or after Title IX?
This is after Title IX.
Okay.
We hadn't really gotten into any kind of Title IX situation here, because remember, it was just on the books in 72. It wasn't to become law until 75. And this is about 73, 74.
Okay.
At this time, Louisville is still all in the process of the state situation.
Mm-hmm.
Athletics has never been a terrible concern in this university,
mm-hmm.
probably never will be.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Hart was the athletic director. Dave was very busy, I think, trying to just get the men's football program
mm-hmm.
in some kind of stable position. Like I said, John Dromo was still here, so we really hadn't done a whole lot in athletics even, other than the past traditions
mm-hmm.
of the school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as I said, at that time I was a coordinator, and I was addressing all my mail to inquiring students that scholarships were not available. Well, I picked up the newspaper one day, and I read where Jeff Johnson had given a couple of swimming scholarships to a couple of girls.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jeff's program was a men's program, and they had told him he could, male or female, he could give scholarships. So Jeff has given two scholarships to women, but I'm the women's coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even have a women's swim team.
Mm-hmm.
I just became incensed, enraged,
mm-hmm.
outraged.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the same time Jeff was giving these two, the university legal affairs office or somebody in the university, and I've got it someplace, decided to give Barbara her scholarship. So here I am coordinating a program, and the law office is giving a scholarship, and the men's swimming team is giving a scholarship, but I'm sitting here with a whole bunch of responsibilities, named the women's coordinator, and I've been telling everybody we don't have scholarships. Well, I was outraged. So I wrote a letter, addressed it to the board of trustees, to the president, to everybody else, that what the hell is going on? You know, either you have a women's program and a coordinator, or you don't. I mean, this department's going to do this, and this department's going to do that. Why am I, you know, being asked to coordinate? And as a result, a direct result of that letter, I was named the assistant athletic director. The position was created. So, in both instances, Barbara's potential lawsuit and my chagrin and anger at this sloppiness regarding women's athletics led to the creation of the women's athletic program being placed in the athletic departments. It went out of PE. And my appointment that year became as a half-time athletic director. And I retained teaching responsibilities and dropped the coaching responsibilities at that time. So I guess that was the beginning of the whole thing. So Dave and I sat down, and with our limited knowledge of Title IX at the time, and believe me, it was very limited, mainly because I think U of L was into the throes of the state. You know, many of the other state schools like Eastern and Murray and Western and everybody were very far ahead of us in terms of their planning. But they weren't fighting this other battle of state monies and absorption of the state. So administratively, I think I've always forgiven the university for that kind of lack of attention, because I do think that was the priority, is to get the institution into the state and then worry about the departments within the institution. Dave and I began to plan a Title IX. We have a Title IX plan, and Clark Wood and I and Ellis, we were all trying to find out where women belonged in the total structure. And we did some fair planning. We did a 10-year project. But you know, at the time, Duane, anything you did 10 years ago, you can't imagine how quickly it changed. Any amount that you could have said you needed 10 years ago, you could not have projected to this day. I mean, things happen so fast, and the growth in women's athletics has been so phenomenal that any dreams we had 10 years ago have already far surpassed our expectations. But that was a start. We offered, I think I was the first female administrator in athletics in the state. In the athletic department. Now, Sue Feimster at UK was the first female administrator in athletics, but she was in the intramural department at UK, and I was in athletics. We offered the first scholarships in the state, which was Barbara. But now, remember, that didn't come as a result of planning. That came as a result of insistence, not foresight, but really, well, maybe foresight. It avoided attack, you know, it avoided legal involvement. And the thing is, like I said, we didn't do a lot of planning. The regional schools did a better job of planning. They were late maybe in bringing their scholarships, but they brought a very good planned program. We brought in the first ones, but we didn't really have a good plan. At least I didn't think we did. Partially because the athletic department at this university has such little influence. There really is no influence. My feeling about it is that this campus basically feels that athletics is an unnecessary expense of the institution. And I feel it's been that way ever since I've been a part of it. What they do is they give the athletic directors over there enough money to get by, but it's not really a priority like it is on some campuses. So our planning was limited a little because you're trying to build football, you're trying to build basketball, mm-hmm. and what's left over for women is mm-hmm. what we got.
Mm-hmm.
Each year, I plugged away with each one of those athletic directors, and Dr. Howard Holman came in, I think, 77, maybe 78. And Howard, for maybe all of the problems he might have had as administrator, mm-hmm. being a good administrator, was a good planner.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I were able to give a new plan to the university, which they accepted. And
mm-hmm.
prepared us for the growth we have today.
Mm-hmm.
The Board of Trustees did make, you know, financial allocations for women, specifically
mm-hmm.
for women to assist in growth.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the only problem with that is that their allocations are still behind because
mm-hmm.
those projected funds might have sounded like a lot of money when they were first allocated and first approved.
Mm-hmm.
But with today's economy and inflation and everything else,
mm-hmm.
they become
mm-hmm.
somewhat limited.
Mm-hmm.
You say, well, we give you $100,000. Well, $100,000 3 years from now, might the same $100,000 to match inflation, might
mm-hmm.
you might need $250,000. I don't really know. That's what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
But still, from 75 to 81, from a zero budget, 74, from no monies to $500,000 is still a good march. And that's the reason for the progress. The basic planning has taken place with the athletic department. It's not necessarily been the university, but it has been the athletic administrators that I have worked for. And it is through them that we have
mm-hmm. You so far, what you just said is I guess if we stopped here, it's kind of glowing. It's a progress report,
yes.
and it's in progress underlined.
Yes.
And you a year or so ago, I don't remember the date, but you. You filed a complaint, or well, I don't know exactly what you call it, the terminology.
I filed a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights.
Talk about that. Talk about that.
All right.
That.
I think that you said it correctly. It is a progress
mm-hmm.
report. There has been significant progress,
mm-hmm.
and I have never, at any of the times that I have discussed our needs, ever diminished
mm-hmm.
that contribution by the
mm-hmm.
university. The reason I have filed the complaint is that while there has been an increase in opportunity, there still is not available to the female athlete
mm-hmm.
on this campus equity
mm-hmm.
in opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
That has come about probably as a result of the fact that the athletic directors
mm-hmm.
or their superiors
mm-hmm.
or whatever, whoever makes budgetary controls,
mm-hmm.
has still not put sufficient funds and resources into the women's program to bring them to a comparable
mm-hmm.
state
mm-hmm.
of competition with men's football and basketball.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that could be only achieved in two ways.
Mm-hmm.
One, you put more money into the women's program that's presently budgeted,
mm-hmm.
new money
mm-hmm.
by the university, or two, you take it from the men's budget to give to the women.
Mm-hmm.
You either have to create new money or slice
mm-hmm.
off, you know, the big pies and give to the little
yeah.
the little ones.
Yeah.
It's my feeling that the commitment that the institution made several years ago was made in good faith, and it
mm-hmm.
was a really strong progress. But the figures that they are holding us to, the financial resources that they are binding us to, were requests made 3 years ago, and they do not accommodate inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And they do not accommodate
mm-hmm.
the rapid growth in the competitive arena that
mm-hmm.
is occurring everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
A perfect example. The state of Florida made $1 million appropriation to each of its state schools, to its women's athletic
mm-hmm.
programs, to accommodate the Title IX opportunity. $1 million per institution in the state. The state of Kentucky has done nothing. The state of Kentucky has said to the institutions, take it out of your own budgets. And I'm saying, well, if the institution doesn't have new monies, if they can't raise new monies, then they have to take it out of old budgets, and they've not been willing to do so. They have not raised either new monies or taken it out of present program to facilitate equity. And when I say equity, let me back up a little. We're not that far from it. But the point is, with the present budget crisis, with no relief, it whatever gains we've made, we're going to lose. That's what's disturbing me, is that where we are, we're going to lose with the present budget crunch. I guess I can only say this. I always use this as an example. If you have a whole pie, and 50% of the pie is your share, and two other people share the quarter, and then somebody comes along and says, now everybody has to be reduced, and you're all the same weight, you all have the same hunger demands, and you all have the same appetites, and that's your share. And then somebody comes along and says, well, we got to take 10% of your share. The 50% shareholder is not going to be nearly as hungry as the 25% shareholders who just lost 10%. 10% of a small budget is far worse than 10% of a very large budget. And that's what's happening to women's athletics. We have reached a point in with our new athletic director where we are being told, we are going to cut your budget the same as we're going to cut men's revenue sports. Well, we don't have any waste. If anything, our programs are presently existing on minimal or less than optimal monies now. And then to take 10% away from it is to destroy any of the growth that has taken place. As compared to some of our other programs, or revenue programs, that I still feel have places where they could cut as much as 20-30%.
There was... let me see how this the issue that you filed with the federal government about Title IX. Now, is that still under consideration? Is that
It's still on file with the Office of Civil Rights, and there, to my understanding, I just heard about this today. There has been a on campus review of my complaint that's taken place now with Dr. Larry Fielding in the PE department. And that review has been placed in the hands of the committee to study the complaint from the council, the athletic council.
Was your decision to do that, was it the result of, I guess probably the result of both, but was it the result of a series of things that you saw happening?
Yes.
It was a result of
a series. And I guess these things, I assume, are here for, because I feel some of this is information I don't want to be public with.
I was going to say a while ago that there's a legal release on this that you can place a time restriction on. And I don't like to place time restrictions on them, but I would rather do that than lose the information. Mm-hmm. And if you want to, I would rather do that than lose the information.
Well, if I don't have to name names, I don't think there's anything in there that bothers me. I just don't want to use names. If you want names,
I'd rather you name names and put a restriction on it.
I would prefer to do that because I really don't.
Right. Okay.
Because from this point on, when we are discussing names, I feel that I may be jeopardizing my own career in higher education.
Okay. There's a legal release form right here, and it has a place for restrictions and...
how would I make the restriction on this particular conversation? I just wanted the restriction could, is on the side of mine.
You could say, I think that it would be a reasonable restriction to say that while this particular, I don't know whether it's a suit or not, but while this particular complaint
is pending,
that this is restricted.
Okay.
Or you could say for 10 years. Presumably it'll be...
How about... I'd say presumably 10 years.
Okay.
Because I'm still in the employment market
okay.
for 10 years.
Okay. Okay.
And I'm not sure that some student gaining this could not
okay,
be.
We'll say 10 years.
Okay.
We'll just say 10
I'll
years.
Do that. Okay.
Okay.
And it says to you, it may not be particularly damaging
yeah.
to somebody else, but it could be to me. It
yeah.
could be damaging.
Sure.
Because
sure.
the individuals I talk about may choose to use it against
sure.
me if they
sure.
knew that I didn't say
sure.
anything. That's why I haven't talked much to the newspaper.
Sure.
Because
yeah.
I know what they'll do with it.
Yeah.
As I said, with Dr. Holman, about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe four, the entire athletic department went through a process called a three-year PCU report. I think the entire university did this.
Uh-huh.
I know the athletic department.
Uh-huh.
And in that, every department or every sport in the athletic department made a three-year projection of goals, objectives. And resources necessary to accomplish those goals and objectives.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a behavioral objective
yeah.
exercise.
Yeah, we did one of the
right.
iPads.
This report was done by myself and with Dr. Holman and
mm-hmm.
with my coaches and everything else, and then stamped approved by the planning departments of the university.
Mm-hmm.
I always felt that with both Dr. Holman and Jack Lingle, who was his assistant, and Dave Hardy,
mm-hmm.
that progress was being made because the monies coming from the board was still being added to our program
mm-hmm.
every year. This past year, the university administration, hired a new athletic director.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Bill Olson.
Yeah.
That decision to hire that athletic director was one that I felt jeopardized the athletic program at the University of Louisville. Mr. Olson is a fine human being. I'm not into a
mm-hmm.
personal situation.
Sure.
He was, and this is not common knowledge, but he was not the choice of the athletic council. The overwhelming choice of the athletic council was denied by Dr. Miller.
Hmm.
That is definitely confidential.
Mm-hmm.
The appointment of Bill, that I have felt from all of my inside knowledge of administration, was a political move made to appease Denny Crum,
mm-hmm.
who was looking to help his assistant acquire a position other than assistant basketball coach. And obviously, I think that Bill wanted the athletic director's job because he saw that as, a move up and an opportunity to stay in this community. And I applaud him for it. I think we all do that. I'm sure that Denny's decision to assist his assistant was something that I would do for my assistant that I felt a great deal of confidence in. However, I felt that those kinds of decisions are not the decisions by which universities plan their futures.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Olson might be a very fine fellow.
Mm-hmm.
He has no athletic administration experience. He had never even been a head coach. And not once in any of the proceedings was anyone in the athletic department asked to interview any of the athletic candidates, any
mm-hmm.
of the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, the athletic department was being told, we just don't care about the people who work over there. This is going to be an administrative appointment, a political appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And that was done.
Mm-hmm.
to me, that's very frightening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Particularly when the president has the council of a count, you know, the advice of a council, adamantly opposed to the selection, and board of trustee members, you know, who are also opposed to the selection, and yet it's made because it was made in order to satisfy a personal and in-house move up.
Mm-hmm.
Then couple that with the budget crisis and the administrative style of Bill, I found that the women's program was perhaps jeopardy unless something was done to preserve the gains that had been made. When I say that, I already explained that situation that when you don't have a lot and then you start taking from it, you're in far greater jeopardy than those programs that have in which you cut. That was the number one concern I had for my program. And when I went over to say, we barely have enough to get by now, the response from Bill was, that's tough. Everybody gets their cut. Everybody takes it off. The other thing is that in a variety of conversations with Bill, it became and become very apparent that he and I have a very personal problem of communication. It's a very difficult thing to say, but I believe that Bill has a very narrow view of women in athletics and athletic perspective. He is an excellent basketball coach. He has lived his entire life in the arena of revenue sports. He has no concept, really, of modern changes that are taking place in the world of athletics. It doesn't even take a very knowledgeable person to know that everywhere, you know, there's growth and acceleration in women's athletics, and it is being pursued vigorously by men who direct programs. And yet Bill just doesn't have that perspective. Yet to him, the only thing that counts are football and basketball and revenue sports. And I said that's an archaic idea, I think. I just have trouble with it. Some of the plans that had been made several years ago to add full-time personnel within the budget restraints that I had, in other words, I had X number of dollars, but to reach those goals, I would say, no, you have that money, but you can't use it for that purpose. So already, the plans that we've made for the last 3 or 4 years are suddenly, we are being told, even if you have the money, I won't approve that. So I'm into an administrative style where our planning is suddenly changing directions. Even if the money's there, it can't be utilized because Bill's concept of what the future is going to be is going to be quite different than any I'd worked with before. So I guess you would just say that I looked around and I said, well, okay, I guess I'm being a little personal, but I worked pretty hard at this damn thing. I've been at it for 10 years, and I think I have the pulse of the athletic community, not just here, but everywhere. And all of a sudden, I've got a very young and inexperienced administrator telling me that that these plans can't, that I don't even listen to them. They just can't do it. Plus, a very personal opinion that I am working with a very chauvinistic individual, in the true sense of chauvinism. Just don't have to listen to women. They're just not important. And, you know, what you do is you give them their tokens and you send them on their way, and that's it. And it was very severe, but they're, that's what happened to me. And I thought about it a great deal of time, and I thought, well, you know, I made the budget cuts and I did the kinds of things that are necessary because that's what I'm supposed to do. But then I began to realize that my program might, in time, have no cheerleader. You know, if you don't have a cheerleader, if you don't have somebody in a position of influence who's supporting you, eventually your programs will die.
Had you felt like you had a cheerleader before?
I felt like I had had cheerleaders in my life.
Who were some of your cheerleaders?
Howard. Yeah. No, I mean, maybe he was a poor organizer, but he was a cheerleader. He felt that there was a place for women's athletics, and that strong women's athletic programs or strong non-revenue programs were just as essential to a good university as a good football team. Jack Langle, who was the assistant AD, was very supportive of what we were trying to do. You know, these people actually went out to a woman's game to see what was going on. They were the first people who actually brought me into the room and said, "Becky, we're planning something. What do you think?" I mean, before you were just told what to do. All of a sudden, I'm getting back to the same administrative style that says, "Well, here's what we're going to do. Now you carry it out." And when you lose that kind of input, when you lose that kind of feeling that you have somebody who wants your impressions and your opinions, even if they turn you down, administratively, you begin to realize that you will not be successful. And I would not be successful under this present administration because my experience, my competence, my know-how, and even the plans that I've gone through 3-4 bosses anyway, the continuity of the department is something that's no longer being listened to. Someone else is making decisions.